It is Monday, January the 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, the top U.S. diplomat in Asia ahead of next month's ASEAN meeting, and what might be on that agenda.
U.S. commitment to ASEAN centrality, the central role that ASEAN plays in Asia-Pacific regional organizations, and also probably greater U.S. support for ASEAN projects.
Also ahead, the strengths or weaknesses of the Islamic State, major snowstorm hitting the U.S. East Coast, plus Dolly turns 70. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Laos, the current chair of the 10-nation Association of Southeast Asian Nations. ASEAN wants to see maritime rights respected while avoiding a military buildup in the disputed South China Sea. After speaking with the Lao Prime Minister, Mr. Kerry today said the Lao leader was very clear he wants a unified ASEAN, maritime rights protected, and avoidance of both militarization and conflict. Today's talks come ahead of next month's ASEAN meeting to be hosted by President Obama in California. Regional analyst Malcolm Cook of the Singapore-based Institute of Southeast Asian Studies was asked by my colleague Victor Beatty if ASEAN is capable of such a united front, given some of the member states' close ties with China.
I don't think so. It hasn't in the past, apart from some relatively low common denominator discussions. And Laos is very close to China economically, and as you mentioned, is landlocked, so has no bilateral interest in the South China Sea. So I think as in 2012, when Cambodia was ASEAN chair, Laos would prefer to limit discussions of the South China Sea during its year of hosting ASEAN.
But there are members of ASEAN who are very concerned about activities in the South China Sea.
Oh, certainly. And the Philippines has taken China to the International Arbitration Tribunal, and the ruling should come closely. Singapore recently permitted U.S. surveillance flights out of Singapore. So the South China Sea issue, the importance of it and how to deal with China in relation to it divides the 10 countries of ASEAN more than it unites them.
What do you think, aside from China, the topic of discussion will be at this special ASEAN meeting in California?
One will be, from an ASEAN point of view, U.S. commitment to ASEAN centrality, the central role that ASEAN plays in Asia-Pacific regional organizations, and also probably greater U.S. support for ASEAN projects. That won't make the headlines, but that'll be a key interest, particularly of the poorer ASEAN member states like Laos and Cambodia. So South China Sea will be the headline, but there'll be lots of other smaller, more development-oriented interests from ASEAN, I think.
Mr. Kerry will also visit Phnom Penh, and he may speak out on human rights.
Secretary of State Kerry will also meet some of the opposition leaders who are under more pressure at the moment in Cambodia. There's a election coming up in 2 years, so talking out about human rights and criticizing, even indirectly, the Hun Sen regime wouldn't be very well received, but probably justified, particularly from an American Secretary of State.
He's rounding out his trip with a stop in Beijing. There, the speculation is that he will press China to put more curbs on North Korea following its fourth nuclear test. And how successful might he be?
Probably not very successful. I'm sure there'll be joint statements or of the frustration that both feel towards North Korea and, you know, and a push for North Korea to live up to its commitments. But China is North Korea's most important economic partner by far, and they are an ally of China as well. So China so far has been hesitant to put too much pressure on North Korea.
Malcolm Cook of the Singapore-based Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden was in Turkey over the weekend, where the subject was the United States and Turkey preparing for a military solution against the Islamic State militants. For some perspective on the strengths of the militant group, sometimes called ISIS, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Noseba Yunus of the Atlantic Council and Harlene Gambier of the Institute for the Study of War. We begin with Ms. Gambier's view of things.
It's probably most helpful to actually frame conversations about how strong or successful ISIS is in terms of asking ourselves first what ISIS's overall objectives are. The group seeks to expand the caliphate that it believes it has already established to all historically Muslim lands, and then to provoke and win an apocalyptic war with the West. And so within Iraq and Syria, we see that while the group, of course, is dealing with adversaries on all sides, it is essentially unchallenged in the core areas of its terrain, and it maintains the ability both to defend its territory and to expand further into Western Syria, which we've seen over the course of the past year. Meanwhile, the group is pursuing regional and international campaigns both to plant these regional affiliates across the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia, and also to inspire and direct these spectacular attacks. And so I think overall, ISIS has shown that it has the ability to be adaptive and resilient, particularly in terms of the global campaign that it's waging.
Turning to you, Noseba Yunus, for your take on ISIS's objectives, and you might even want to talk about its origins, who these people are, since many of them are supposedly Saddamists, those who were defeated after the U.S.-led invasion, and other elements. And to what extent do you see them as being very adaptive and perhaps resilient toward the U.S.-led and Western-led military operations against them?
Yes, Islamic State is a very strange mix of people. You certainly do have former Iraqi Ba'athists who take quite a central role in the group, particularly in terms of defining its military strategy, but also in terms of putting together and executing its strategy in terms of social control over the local populations in the towns that it occupies. And the strategies it uses, intimidation, torture, is right out of Saddam Hussein's playbook. They really take instruction from what was an incredibly secular Ba'athist regime. But those methods and that methodology has very much found its way into the Islamic State through former Ba'athist military officers, even though they were former Ba'athists, and there may have been an element of pursuing this marriage of convenience with extremist ISIS elements. I think actually now for many of them, they are true believers and core ISIS figureheads.
Noseba Yunus is with the Atlantic Council. She and Harlene Gambier, a counterterrorism analyst at the Institute for the Study of War, spoke with Carol Castiel. She's host of the VOA program Encounter. Recent opinion polls show that terrorism and national security are at the top of the list of U.S. voter concerns. Just a few days before the first contest for the 2016 presidential election begin in Iowa and New Hampshire, in particular, the war in Syria and countering the so-called Islamic State have been the focus of intense debate among White House contenders from both political parties. Here's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
The conflict in Syria and the battle against the so-called Islamic State remain major U.S. foreign policy challenges. And some sharp differences have emerged in the debates among those seeking the White House this year. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump has vowed to destroy Islamic State jihadists as a key step in keeping the U.S. safe from terrorist attack.
We need a toughness. We need strength. We're not respected as a nation anymore. We don't have that level of respect that we need. And if we don't get it back fast, we're just going to go weaker, weaker, and just disintegrate. We can't allow that to happen.
Trump's main rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, favors airstrikes.
Right now, Obama is launching between 15 and 30 air attacks a day. It is photo op foreign policy. We need to use overwhelming air power. We need to be arming the Kurds. We need to be fighting and killing ISIS where they are.
But Florida Senator Marco Rubio argues the key is an international ground force.
Airstrikes are a key component of defeating them, but they must be defeated on the ground by a ground force. And that ground force must be primarily made up of Sunni Arabs themselves.
Rubio also favors regime change in Syria, while Cruz and fellow Republican contender Rand Paul do not. In the Democratic contest, frontrunner Hillary Clinton also favors an aggressive military campaign against Islamic State fighters, but one that avoids using large numbers of U.S. troops.
They want American troops back in the Middle East. They want American soldiers on the ground fighting them, giving them many more targets and giving them a great recruiting opportunity.
Her main challenger, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, disagrees with Clinton over the need for regime change in Syria.
It is not Assad who was attacking the United States. It is ISIS. And ISIS is attacking France and attacking Russian airliners. The major priority right now in terms of our foreign and military policy should be the destruction of ISIS.
Concerns over terrorism in particular will play a dominant role in the campaign, says John Fortier.
When it comes to terrorism, where they think it could come to America, when they see ISIS beheading Americans or the attacks in Paris or in San Bernardino, then it becomes a more real issue, and I think that's what some Republicans are seizing on.
In recent polls, voters rate terrorism and national security their top concern over the traditional top issue, the economy. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
You can keep up to date with the U.S. political scene at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
VOA News. VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. It'll be days before life returns to normal along the U.S. East Coast after a massive winter storm brought blizzards, floods, and record-shattering snowfall to tens of millions of Americans. The U.S. government is closed today for all but emergency employees as Washington digs out and recovers from one of the largest snowstorms to ever hit the nation's capital. We asked Jack Boston, senior meteorologist at AccuWeather, if this was a historic blizzard.
Absolutely a historic blizzard. In New York City, for example, at Central Park, only missed the all-time record for one storm by a tenth of an inch. Well, actually, that would be 2 centimeters. But anyway, the total snowfall in New York City was 68 centimeters. The record is 70 centimeters. So they just Central Park just missed it. That's why you would call it a historic blizzard.
Two of my colleagues were out in that blizzard, or at least in the aftermath of it. Jim Stevenson walked through the deep snow to get to work, and then there's Michael Lippin, who has a special reason for being an expert on snow.
The sound of snowball fighting. A lot of people from Washington to New York are enjoying a huge snowfall that arrived Friday and Saturday. And, of course, it included those snowball fights, of which our own Michael Lippin is quite familiar with. Michael, hello.
Hi, Jim. I'm familiar because I actually organize these things.
We'll blame you. It's pretty exciting, though. A big turnout today.
We did, yeah. I organized the snowball fight of the Washington, D.C. Snowball Fight Association. It's a thing. It's a Facebook page. And we had hundreds of people turn out to DuPont Circle Park, which is one of the really popular parks in Northwest Washington. And not only do we have lots of cheers and yells and screams, we even had a DJ playing.
All right, we are here with Julius Snell, also known as DJ Josh, right?
Yeah, DJ Josh.
You brought the music again.
Yeah, it's fun.
Thanks so much for doing this, man.
Yeah, I need to come down here.
So much fun, Jen.
Well, this really illustrates the power of social media, though, Michael, because you've organized this online and so many people got together because of what was posted.
Exactly, yeah. You know, we use Facebook to mobilize these kinds of get-togethers for snowball fights. We have this Facebook page called the DCSFA, the DC Snowball Fight Association, and then we create an event through that page. And, you know, when you time that event with a big snowfall, people just gravitate to that so quickly. It spreads like wildfire because people will tag their friends. They'll say they'll invite their friends. And we had something like 3,000 RSVPs to this event today. About, maybe 500 people or so turned out because there was no Metro Underground train service today. So people really had to walk there.
Thanks, Michael. That's International Edition's Michael Lippin. You can find him on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. Jim Stevenson is there as well at VOA Stevenson. I'm also on Twitter. You can find me at VOA Norman. And International Edition's Twitter handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Canadian researchers have found that nonverbal human sounds of emotion, such as a scream of anger or alarm, a cry of sadness, or a laugh of joy, are able to better communicate feelings than spoken words. Writing in a study published by the journal Biological Psychology, the scientists from Montreal's McGill University also discovered that our brains respond in just 1/10 of a second to these non-spoken vocalizations. They say our ability to quickly recognize the non-spoken sounds of emotion was a matter of human survival long before language was developed. Working with 24 research subjects, the scientists found that sounds of happiness, like laughter, registered quicker with the volunteers than sounds of sadness or anger. But angry sounds and speech produced longer-lasting brain activity in their subjects' brains than either happiness or sadness. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, American singer, actress, author, businesswoman, and humanitarian Dolly Parton turned 70 years old just a few days ago. And across all media platforms, many in country music and beyond celebrated. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks with VOA Music's Nikki Strong about why Dolly is so beloved.
Nikki, give us a quick overview of Dolly's accomplishments.
Okay, well, Dolly's an incredible personality overall. Musically, she's prolific. Islands in the Stream, 9 to 5, Jolene, the list goes on. She is the most honored female country performer of all time. She's been in the business for over 50 years. She started as a child. She's had 25 number one songs on the Billboard Country Charts, a record for a female artist. She has 41 top 10 country albums, which is a record for any artist. And even though she has garnered 8 Grammy Awards, she has received 46 Grammy nominations, tying her with Bruce Springsteen for the most Grammy nominations and placing her in 10th place overall. And she's in the Country Music Hall of Fame. There's so many awards, too many to mention. I will say this, she is also one of the very few artists who have received at least one nomination for an Oscar, a Grammy, a Tony, and an Emmy.
Very impressive.
Yes.
Well, Dolly's a great storyteller and she's got a distinctive look.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Dolly is just an experience. And not just in the lyrics of her music, but how she would share stories about her life. And even in her look, she said that she modeled herself after the town tramp with big blonde hair and high heels and red fingernails and lips. She said to her, you know, the town tramp was like a movie star for her and the kids. And her mother would say, oh, she ain't nothing but trash, nothing but trash. And Dolly said, ooh, that's what I'm going to be when I grow up. Trash. But you know, for her to even see the value of what others deem trash and embrace it and affirm it is a part of her charm and why people really love her. She also told stories about what it was like growing up poor. And in one of them, she says, the kids peed on me every night. And this is a quote. She said, there were so many of us. So we slept 3 or 4 in the bed. I would wash every night. And as soon as I go to bed, the kids would wet on me. And I'd have to get up in the morning and do the same thing. But that was the only warm thing we knew in the wintertime. That was almost a pleasure to get peed on because it was so cold. Lord, it was as cold in the room as it was outside.
Wow, yeah. And so it should be noted, she's one of 12 kids.
One of 12 kids with an incredible rags to riches story. And she's always been grounded and transparent and proud of her roots and her faith-filled roots, too, and how her upbringing has made her who she is.
Well, she's done a lot of philanthropy.
She has. She has the Dollywood Foundation, which a lot of people know, and it's widely known for her literacy program, Imagination Library, in which she distributes more than 10 million free books a year to children annually. She's raised money for the Red Cross and HIV/AIDS-related causes, to name a few as well.
Well, her movies captured her charisma as well.
Oh, yeah. She's great. From Steel Magnolias, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, 9 to 5, you know Dolly as a force to be reckoned with, and you loved it. So it's the kind of force that I think makes the world a better place. And as you know, she recently produced the movie Code of Colors, based on her life, and she is working on the film Jolene, which is based on her hit song, which, of course, is about a woman who knows her power to make men cheat. So I'm looking forward to that story. Dolly Parton is one of a kind, and so we couldn't help but celebrate her all throughout social media and beyond.
All right, well, there's much to celebrate. Happy birthday, Dolly Parton. You can hear more of Dolly's music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you, Sarah.
Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 please don't take him just because you can.
Ah, Dolly's music. It's great stuff. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Have a great Monday, everyone.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Entering its last year in office, the Obama administration has made it clear that engagement with Asia continues to be a top priority, with an agenda that includes economic, security, and political cooperation with Asian partners. In 2016, the United States will push for approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries. The United States will also continue to modernize its alliances and to deepen security relationships with emerging partners. In the Asia-Pacific region, the United States is ready to support its allies in building maritime security, humanitarian disaster relief, and counter-piracy capacity. Maritime security and territorial issues will be clearly on the agenda this year as well, said Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications Ben Rhodes during a recent speech at the Washington Foreign Press Center. The United States is committed to upholding freedom of navigation, he said. On issues like the South China Sea disputes, we'd like to encourage all parties to de-escalate tensions and resolve their issues through international law. The United States will also continue to cooperate with China on issues of common interest. So, for example, last year, one of the biggest issues that we focused on domestically and internationally was climate change, said Mr. Rhodes.
We would not have achieved the Paris Agreement without the cooperation that the United States and China had on that issue, both in terms of the announcement made in Beijing during his last trip and the subsequent cooperation leading into Paris.
We are going to work very closely with China on a whole range of issues related to the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Rhodes. For example, we'll be working with China through the UN Security Council and also in our own bilateral discussions about how to demonstrate to North Korea that its recent nuclear test and the threat it poses to our allies and to the world will lead to greater costs, consequences, and isolation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Welcome.